Coon Review Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CoeNReview. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@coeNReview.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
The Herald Scotland, on Wednesday the 1st of November 2023. From the news section. Renfrew Alistair Campbell, Police Launch Murder Probe. An article written by Jodie Harrison and read by me, Corey. The death of a man who was found seriously injured in a stairwell in Renfrew is being treated as murder. Police have launched an investigation after Alistair Campbell died shortly after being found seriously injured in the Common Close of flats on Renfield Street, around 3 a.m. on Monday, 30th of October 2023. The probe is centred on two men who assaulted the 52-year-old and fled in the direction of the town's Wilson Street. Detective Chief Inspector Graham McCready, Police Scotland's major investigation team, said, "From our inquiries so far, we know that Alistair was seriously assaulted by two men on Renfield Street at the junction of Wilson Street around 1 a.m. The two suspects then ran off along Wilson Street towards Houston Street in Renfrew Town Centre. We believe both men to be white. One was wearing a dark tracksuit and dark trainers, and the other had either a light grey or khaki jacket, dark trousers and dark trainers. We'd appeal to anyone who was in either Renfrew Town Centre or Renfield Street between 40 minutes past 12 a.m. and 3 a.m. on Monday morning and saw anything that may assist our investigation to get in touch. We're also keen to get a hold of any dash cam, private CCTV or doorbell footage from around that time. An increased police presence has been established in the area while officers carry out their extensive inquiries into the incident. An online portal that allows members of the public to send information directly to the major investigation team has been set up. To access the portal and to send information directly to the major investigation team, go to www.mipp.police.uk/operation/sct23s37-p01%c2%a0. That code at the end again is sct23s37-p01%c2%a0. DCI McCready added, "Alistair's family and friends will continue to be supported throughout our inquiries. It's vital we find out exactly what happened to him, and I'm appealing to the public for help to do that. If you have any information that may assist officers with their inquiries, then please get in touch as soon as you can." That article was from the Herald Scotland. It was from the news section. It was written by Jodie Harrison, and it was read by me, Corey. The Herald Scotland, on Wednesday, the 1st of November, 2023. From the news section. Social bite to open Dundee Village to help drug addicts. An article written by Gabriel McKay and read by me, Corey. A renowned homeless charity has announced it will open a recovery centre in Dundee for people struggling with addiction issues. Social Bite has gone from a small coffee shop in Edinburgh to a project supporting some of society's most vulnerable people, which has been visited and supported by the likes of Leonardo DiCaprio and George Clooney. In 2018, the charity opened a homeless village in Edinburgh, providing support for up to 20 people by giving them a place to sleep, helping them learn new skills, and helping them with work and voluntary placements. Following the success of that project, Social Bite has announced it will open a new centre in Dundee, which will expand the focus from exclusively homelessness to supporting a range of vulnerable people struggling with addiction. Last year, 1,051 people in Scotland died for drug-related reasons, by far the highest rate of any country in Europe, including the rest of the UK. Scotland's drug death rate is still more than three times higher than the next worst affected European country. Dundee City was second only to Glasgow City in drug deaths, with by 43.1 deaths per 100,000 people. The new centre will house a state-of-the-art recovery facility, and residents of the village will also be supported by on-site staff and a local network of resources dedicated to helping people with addiction. Social Bite are working in partnership with addiction specialist charity We Are With You to develop a tailored support model for the village that works for the needs of people in Dundee. The accommodation at the Dundee project will be 15 eco-friendly prefabricated nest houses with a bedroom, kitchen, lounge area and storage. Alongside a community hub complete with communal dining space, gym facilities and counselling rooms. Bespoke individual residential units will be constructed to create a secure and private community environment, and everyone who is given a place in the village will be supported through the process to find permanent accommodation as part of their recovery, should that be required. Josh Littlejohn, MBE, founder of Social Bite, said, "This is an incredibly exciting project for Social Bite and for Dundee. It has been amazing to collaborate with the local community on developing something that will meet a great need in the city. We all know the problem with drug deaths in Scotland and Dundee over the years. The human toll is profound. Behind each statistic lies individual and familial suffering, with communities losing loved ones. Deprivation exacerbates the crisis, with those in the poorest areas 16 times more likely to die from drug misuse. The Recovery Village will help people on their journey towards recovery by providing a safe and rehabilitative living environment and expert support. Everyone we have spoken to in Dundee about the project has been hugely supportive, and we are delighted to see that the city is taking the international lead on what could become a pioneering model for tackling addiction amongst vulnerable people. Social Bite is in discussion with Dundee City Council on a site for the project, and expects to be able to submit a full planning application before the end of the year. The WM Sword Charitable Trust has made a £1.5 million pledge towards the project, in memory of the benefactor of the trust, the late Bill Sword, a well-known entrepreneur in Dundee. Lynn Henderson, trustee of the WM Sword Charity Trust, said, "The trust has been looking for some time for a major project to support on top of the work we do on a smaller scale with dozens of charities in Tayside. The Recovery Village is a fantastic idea, and the ambition and vision is something that we know the city will get behind and become proud of as it gets up and running. My father was incredibly proud of Dundee, and he would have been delighted to know that the fruits of many of his businesses were now going to help Dundorians at their time of greatest need. The Insights Foundation will provide an extra £100,000 of support for the project. CEO Andy Lothan said, "Having supported Social Bite for over a decade, the Insights Foundation are thrilled to support this new recovery village in Dundee, addressing one of the city's most pressing needs. I would like to encourage the business and philanthropic community to join ourselves and WM Sword in getting behind this vital initiative, to create a world-leading recovery facility for vulnerable people in our home city, and I can't wait to see it come to life." That article was from the Herald Scotland, it was from the news section, it was written by Gabriel McKay, and it was read by me, Corey.
From the Herald Scotland, Wednesday the 1st of November, from the Voices section, opinion, Brexit, Ian McConnell, insolvency show truth or folly, by Group Business Editor Ian McConnell. It was interesting, though hardly surprising, to hear the administrators of Orkney's Fishermen's Society flag Brexit as a factor in this long-established supplier of crabs, lobster and other fresh seafood falling into insolvency. Thankfully, there was a relatively happy ending on this occasion. Joint administrators Michelle Elliott and Callum Carmichael, partners with FRP Advisory, announced they had sold the business and assets of Orkney's Fishermen's Society to Orkney Crab, a subsidiary of Oban Company PDK Shellfish, in a deal that saved all 55 jobs. The administrators flagged significant recruitment issues arising from Brexit as they detailed the causes of the fall of Orkney Fishermen's Society into administration. The enormous damage to the overall economy from Brexit is plain for all to see and has been quantified astutely by many experts. Back in the spring, Office for Budget Responsibility Chairman Richard Hughes summed up Brexit's effect as follows. "We think that in the long run it reduces our overall output by around 4% compared with had we remained in the EU. He added, "It's a shock to the UK economy of the order of magnitude of those sorts of other shocks that we've seen from the pandemic, from the energy crisis." Centre for European Reform Deputy Director John Springford's latest report on the cost of leaving the European Union to the UK economy, published last December, estimates that Brexit had, by the second quarter of 2022, reduced the country's gross domestic product by 5.5%. These are huge figures. So it should be no surprise that Brexit has often been on the lips of insolvency practitioners when it has come to explaining the collapse of companies or why firms are in dire straits. That said, those who have been taken in by the Brexiters' tall tales might be surprised. The joint administrators of Orkney Fishermen's Society declared, "The administration was caused by unsustainable cash flow problems stemming from the effects of the COVID pandemic, significant recruitment issues arising from Brexit, and an acute shortage of crab in 2018 due to adverse weather." So Brexit was clearly flagged as a significant factor in the fall of the business, which was founded in 1953 and had clearly survived many tumultuous times, into administration. The Conservatives' hard Brexit, which brought the loss of free movement of people between the UK and European Economic Area, has fueled skills and labour shortages across Britain, with more remote and rural areas amongst those places badly affected. Scotland's hospitality sector has highlighted the detrimental impact of Brexit on operators' ability to find staff, and when Country Bumpkins Children's Nursery at Ardersia near Inverness fell into insolvency in June, joint provisional liquidators Ian Wright and Scott Milne of Quantanamo highlighted the effect of Brexit. They said, "The nursery, along with many in the private sector, had experienced difficulties in finding suitably trained staff as many had migrated to council settings offering improved pay and benefits. Added to this was a post-Brexit reduction in the Highlands labour market, all of which led to reliance on agency staff and increased costs. In recent years, the nursery's revenues had remained steady, despite both the pandemic and increased levels of home working. However, the staffing difficulties and increased costs meant that the company ceased to be economically viable. The nursery employed 30 staff, with all roles made redundant when this business fell into liquidation. Mr. Milne said, "A combination of extremely difficult trading conditions, including a reduced labour market and increasing costs, has seen the business unable to continue. When Edinburgh-based Atterley.com retail closed with immediate effect last December with a loss of 22 jobs, Brexit was flagged as a factor." Brian Milne of French Duncan LLP said in the immediate wake of his appointment as joint professional liquidator of the retailer, "Atterley.com Retail Limited is unable to continue to trade due to a number of market-related reasons. The business has recently been impacted by higher distribution and postage costs involved in sending out products to customers. There has also been an increase in export and import costs due to Brexit, and this has impacted on the viability of the business. Brexit is also highlighted by insolvency specialists when they are discussing the general situation. David Fleming, UK head of restructuring at Specialist Crawl, said during the summer month of general insolvency situation, "Last year we saw a huge surge of liquidators among small businesses. Many of these failures were companies that had struggled through the pandemic and simply ran out of options. The companies we are now seeing are managing a mixture of issues relating to Brexit, Ukraine, inflationary pressures, and increased borrowing costs against a backdrop of leveraged balance sheets. This year it's highly likely we will see administration surpass the pre-pandemic average for the first time." James Burgess, head of commercial at trade credit and insolvency expert Atradius, said in January, "Firms across the board are facing an unprecedented number of challenges, from the continued fallout of Brexit and the COVID-19 pandemic, to labour shortages and soaring energy costs. Many business leaders will no doubt already be having difficult conversations about whether they continue to operate at all, let alone profitably." Trade credit specialist Alliance Trade meanwhile said of the UK situation last month, "Domestic firms have been made fragile by the succession of knocks and challenges they had to manage over the past years. Brexit-related issues, COVID-19 shock, earlier monetary tightening, rapid and sticky inflation. We expect firms to remain so in 2024-25, while the economic and financing outlook is only moderately improving by 2025 and while firms are exposed to the debt repayment wall. What is clear from all of this, as should have been obvious anyway, is that Brexit is not done in any way, as the ruling Conservatives like to claim. And we must absolutely guard against the narrative that Brexit is something we should no longer talk about because it's somehow in the past. Its pernicious effects have been felt far and wide, as can be seen in insolvencies of all sorts of companies and other situations of company distress, as well as in many other places." And that was an opinion piece by Group Business Editor Ian McConnell.
This is from the Herald Scotland, on Thursday the 2nd of November 2023, from the news section. Teddy bear protest in memory of Palestinian children, held in Glasgow. This article is written by Katrina Stewart. Hundreds of parents and children gathered in the centre of Glasgow yesterday to protest the bombardment of Gaza as the conflict between Israel and Hamas continues. The group, Parents for Palestine Glasgow, held a static protest in George Square in solidarity with the Palestinian community. During the event, children laid cuddly toys in the city's civic centre in memory and acknowledgement of the 3,100 children who have been killed in Gaza by the Israeli Defence Force, IDF, this month. A spokesperson for the event said it was held to express our utter heartbreak and devastation for the thousands of children's lives lost, and extend our deepest solidarity to Palestinian parents and carers. She added, more than 600 parents, carers and children are expected to join this peaceful protest and vigil, designed to help make a space for the grief experienced by people and to remember and mark the lives of the children lost. We also express disgust to the UK government about their continued inaction. We demand that the UK government calls for a ceasefire, withdraws its support for Israeli war crimes, and immediately ends arms sales to Israel. Nearly half, around 1 million, residents of Palestine are children. On Saturday last week, October the 28th, Israel imposed a telephone and internet blackout in Gaza, leaving residents unable to contact friends and family outside the territory. The protest came as it emerged the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt has opened for the first time in more than 3 weeks to allow the evacuation of dozens of injured Palestinians requiring hospital treatment and hundreds of foreign passport holders. Meanwhile, Israeli airstrikes have hit apartment buildings in a Gaza refugee camp for the second day in a row, Palestinian officials said. Al Jazeera Television, one of the few media outlets still reporting from northern Gaza, aired footage of devastation in the Jabalia camp near Gaza City and of several wounded people, including children, being taken to a nearby hospital. The Hamas-run government said the strikes killed and wounded many people, but the exact toll is not yet known. Al Jazeera footage showed nearly identical scenes as the day before, with dozens of men digging through the grey rubble of demolished multi-story buildings in search of survivors. The toll from Tuesday's strikes was also unknown, though the director of a nearby hospital said hundreds were killed or wounded. Israel said those strikes killed dozens of militants, including a senior Hamas commander involved in the militants' bloody October the 7th rampage that ignited the war and destroyed militant tunnels beneath the buildings. In a sign of increasing alarm over the war among Arab countries, Jordan, on Wednesday, recalled its ambassador from Israel and told Israel's ambassador to remain out of the country. Jordan, a key US ally, signed a peace deal with Israel in 1994, the second Arab country after Egypt to do so. The strikes came as Israeli ground forces pushed to the outskirts of Gaza City, days after launching a new phase of the war that Israel's leaders say will be long and difficult. As when Israeli troops first pushed into Gaza in larger numbers over the weekend, internet and phone service was cut for several hours on Wednesday. The isolated Palestinian enclave, home to 2.3 million people, is in the grip of a severe humanitarian crisis amid a siege imposed by Israel in the wake of the October the 7th attack. More than half the population have fled their homes and supplies of food, medicine, water and fuel are running low. A territory-wide blackout has left hospitals reliant on generators that could shut down soon, as Israel has barred all fuel imports. The strikes in Jabalia underline the anticipated surge in casualties on both sides as Israeli troops advance towards the outskirts of Gaza City and its dense residential neighbourhoods. Israeli officials say Hamas's military infrastructure, including hundreds of miles of underground tunnels, is concentrated in the city, which was home to some 650,000 people before the war. Despite the deteriorating circumstances, no one has been allowed to leave Gaza except for 4 hostages released by Hamas. Another captive was rescued by Israeli forces earlier this week, but a limited agreement appeared to have been reached on Wednesday. The Palestinian Crossing Authority said more than 400 foreign passport holders would be permitted to leave for Egypt, as would some wounded people. Egypt, however, has said it will not allow an influx of Palestinian refugees because of fears Israel will not allow them to return to Gaza after the war. Dozens of people could be seen entering the Rafah crossing, the only one currently operating, and ambulances carrying wounded Palestinians exited on the Egyptian side. More than 80 Palestinians, out of many thousands wounded in the war, will be brought in for treatment, Egypt's health ministry said, and a field hospital has been set up in an Egyptian town near the crossing. The Palestinian health ministry, meanwhile, said that Gaza's only hospital offering specialized treatment for cancer patients was forced to shut down because of a lack of fuel, leaving 70 cancer patients in a critical situation. More than 8,500 Palestinians have been killed in the war, mostly women and children, and more than 21,000 people have been wounded, the Gaza Health Ministry said on Tuesday, without providing a breakdown between civilians and fighters. The figure is without precedent in decades of Israeli-Palestinian violence. More than 1,400 people have died on the Israeli side, mainly civilians killed during Hamas's initial attack, also an unprecedented figure. Palestinian militants also abducted around 240 people during their incursion and have continued firing rockets into Israel. The Israeli military confirmed on Wednesday that 9 soldiers have been killed in fighting in northern Gaza, bringing the total number of soldiers killed since the start of the ground operation to 11. The UK government has twice vetoed a UN resolution for a ceasefire. That article was written by Katrina Stewart.
From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 2nd of November, from the sports section, SPFL blast, very concerning and unwelcome Rangers pyro display. Article by sports writer David Irvin. The SPFL have branded the use of pyrotechnics by Rangers supporters last night as very concerning and unwelcome. Players were taken off the pitch just 2 minutes into the delayed kick-off of the match between Dundee and Rangers due to the pyrotechnics display. It's understood smoke alarms inside the stadium were set off by smoke from the devices. Referee Kevin Clancy ordered the players off the pitch while the matter was resolved before Rangers ran out 5-0 winners at Dens Park. Now, the SPFL have blasted the pyro display and vowed to work alongside Police Scotland on the incident, with a delegate report yet to be received. An SPFL spokesperson said, "The extensive use of pyrotechnics at the match at Dens Park is very concerning and unwelcome. The disruption to the game is obviously extremely regrettable. We await the delegate report and will be liaising with Police Scotland on the incident." And that article was by David Irvin.
Herald Scotland recorded on Friday, 3rd of November 2023. Arts and Entertainments. The Beatles' Now and Then Review, A Final Love Letter to the World, by Kevin McNabb. Once upon a long ago, the world went into a kind of paralysis when the Beatles released a new single. Such was the trance-like sway they held over Western culture. The hourglass encasing the 60s seemed to fracture for an instant, holding all those grains of sands in a timeless swirl as fans of the Fabs rejoiced in the latest song to trundle off the Lennon-McCartney production line. It is now 60 years since Beatlemania engulfed first Britain and then, via America, the world. No one then imagined that here in 2023, the music of the Beatles would still command so much rapt public and media attention. Today's release of Now and Then, an exhumed John Lennon demo which has been sonically repurposed through the latest advances in technical wizardry, underpins the insatiable fascination, some might say obsession, we still have for the Beatles. But amid all this allure lies an ineluctable truth. Now and Then cannot possibly scale the same heights as those classic Beatles singles such as She Loves You, Day Tripper, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Help, Penny Lane, Lady Madonna, Something, and Hey Jude. Put simply, we live in different times, and the Beatles were a product of their times. That was then, this is now. While some fans are delighted to hear even the most embryonic of Beatles releases, others would simply prefer that they let it be, and that perhaps partly explains The sharp online divisions the song has created among the group's multi-generational fanbase, particularly over its origins and tangled recording history. Lennon workshopped Now and Then in the late 70s, during his five-year hiatus from the music industry, by recording his slightly tinny vocal onto a cassette recorder perched on top of a piano at his New York home. Rough and rudimentary, the song was lyrically unfinished and seemingly unloved by its author. Proof lies in the fact Lennon never took the song into the studio where he was currently shaping his comeback album Double Fantasy, and his tragic murder in December 1980 ensured the track, and the cassette it was recorded on, remained permanently locked away inside the Dakota apartment he shared with wife Yoko Ono and young son Sean, as well as slamming down a sarcophagus lid on any future Beatles reunion, and that likely would have been the song's fate, along with a clutch of other undeveloped demos Lennon had been working on prior to his death at the age of 40. Fast forward, however, to the early 90s, which marked a thaw in familial relations between Ono and, especially, Paul McCartney and George Harrison. Following Lennon's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame by McCartney, she offered up the tantalising prospect of using the songs for the Beatles Anthology project, a massive retrospective of their storied career. And so it was that the Threetles, as the media dubbed the surviving trio, regrouped at McCartney's home studio alongside uber-fan-turned-producer Geoff Lynne to try and salvage the three songs in Ono's tapes. Two of them, Three is a Bird and Real Love, passed the quality kite mark, just, but Now and Then languished in the board, a lo-fi car crash. Parts of the song's ghostly vocals were largely muffled, and the accompanying mains cycle hum simply couldn't be removed, leaving it sonically doomed. And there was another impediment. Harrison dismissed it to McCartney's face as F*** rubbish, consequently ripping apart the Beatles' musketeer mantra that, if one of them had no faith in a song, it was instantly jettisoned for something better. Inevitably, Lennon's original demo found itself swirling in a Beatles afterlife on the internet, attracting curious interest from fans, bootleggers and digital musicians who simply took the vocal and overlaid it onto their own versions of the song. McCartney, meanwhile, simply refused to let Now and Then wither in the vine, digital or otherwise. Doggedly convinced of its merits, he repeatedly told friends that one day he would sneak into the studio and finish the song. His reasons to place a tick against this bucket list type ambition were intrinsically personal. Beatle folklore has it that the cassette Lennon recorded the song on was marked For Paul. Fanciful as this notion sounds, in McCartney's mind it nevertheless imbued the song with untold depths of emotion. Hope then arrived from the most unlikeliest of sources. In 2021, Peter Jackson, the Oscar-winning New Zealand filmmaker, oversaw a restored 9-hour version of Let It Be, the 1969 movie which captured the band's self-immolation. Using the latest audio software, Team Jackson brought the outmoded dialogue and songs magically into the 21st century. When he informed McCartney he could use the same techniques to isolate and extract Lennon's vocal in other songs, hinting at the use of artificial intelligence, Paul's interest in reviving Now and Then was again piqued. Over the past 18 months, the song has undergone a remarkable metamorphosis. Ringo Starr, after some mild hesitation, agreed to lay down new drum parts, and they had Harrison's guitar parts from the original sessions in the 90s, recorded before his death from cancer in 2001. Giles Martin, son of the band's legendary producer George, was drafted in to oversee the addition of a wistful and quintessentially Beatles string arrangement. It says much for McCartney's powers of persuasion that he was able to convince Harrison's widow Olivia and their musician son Danny to set aside George's initial cheerless judgment and sign off on the song. In mitigation, Danny is now insisting his father's antipathy centred in the track's technical limitations rather than the quality of the song itself. The result is a track that has risen phoenix-like from the ashes to become the Beatles' final love letter to the world and to each other. It should come as no surprise then that the finished product is an unexpected triumph. What could have been a Frankenstein-type AI pastiche is instead a fully realised Beatles record, one where its dreamy psychedelic flow lets Lennon's hauntingly beautiful vocal linger in your mind. The recording's wistful undercurrents allow fans to be grateful for what they gave us as much as grieving for what was lost, and it remains eerily comforting to hear all four Beatles coming together one last time on a new song the same way they used to do Now and Then back in those carefree days when he was fab. Ken McNabb is an author and journalist whose new Beatles book, Shake It Up Baby, is out now by Ken McNabb.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Friday, the 3rd of November, 2023, from the news section. Nicola Sturgeon told to end pitiful stonewalling on COVID WhatsApps. Report by Tom Gordon. Nicola Sturgeon has been urged to end her bogus and pitiful stonewalling and tell Holyrood whether she destroyed potential evidence to the UK and Scottish COVID inquiries. Douglas Ross said the former First Minister should make an urgent statement on whether she had deleted WhatsApp messages and stop her insult to the bereaved. In a letter to Ms Sturgeon, the Scottish Tory leader accused her of a lack of candour and said she should come clean immediately. On Tuesday, Ms Sturgeon repeatedly refused to say whether she had kept WhatsApp messages dating from her time handling Scotland's response to the pandemic. She said she had nothing to hide and was committed to full transparency, but said her recent submissions to the UK COVID inquiry were confidential. After the Sunday Mail reported that she had deleted her WhatsApps, she said she would tell the UK inquiry what I hold, what I don't hold, and the reasons for that. However, the inquiry then confirmed that, while the content of Ms Sturgeon's submissions was confidential for now, there was no gag on her talking to the press in general terms. Her position was further undermined by First Minister Hamza Yousaf and former Finance Secretary Kate Forbes revealing they kept and submitted their WhatsApps to the inquiry after ignoring Scottish Government guidance on deleting old messages. Mr Ross, who said at First Minister's questions on Thursday that destroying potential evidence to the inquiry was breaking the law, said Ms Sturgeon could no longer hide behind process. He said, Nicola Sturgeon cannot persist with her bogus and pitiful stonewalling in response to this vital yet very simple question. It's an insult to those who lost loved ones during the pandemic for our former First Minister to hide behind process for refusing to say whether or not she deleted WhatsApp messages. Her confidentiality excuse was already painfully weak, given the likes of Hamza Yousaf and Kate Forbes were happy to answer the same question. But the COVID inquiry has now blown it to smithereens. What Nicola Sturgeon is reported to have done looks to constitute law-breaking. So, she has to address this issue head-on, either via a public statement or a personal statement in Parliament. It's in Nicola Sturgeon's own interest to belatedly provide clarity if her already shredded reputation is to retain a semblance of credibility. In his letter, a follow-up to one he sent on Monday, he told Ms Sturgeon, the UK COVID inquiry has confirmed there are no restrictions on what witnesses can say to the media regarding their actions during the pandemic. Your lack of candour is an insult to those who lost loved ones in the pandemic. It's in the public interest that you immediately reveal once and for all whether you deleted messages, and if so, when? Did you delete them after you had announced that a Scottish COVID inquiry would be established? Were the messages deleted before or after the Do Not Destroy notice issued by the Scottish Government? The SNP has been asked for comment. Ms Sturgeon's spokesperson said, in the interests of everyone who has been impacted by the COVID pandemic, Nicola is committed to full transparency to both the UK and Scottish COVID inquiries. Any messages she had, she handled and dealt with in line with the Scottish Government's policies. She will continue to provide all information requested by the inquiry that she holds and will continue to cooperate fully. She has recently submitted her third written statement to the UK inquiry, running to around 200 pages, and expects to give oral evidence again next year when she will answer all questions put to her. That report was by Tom Gordon. This is from the Herald Scotland on Friday, the 3rd of November, 2023. From the news section. SNP ministers publish immigration section of independence prospectus. Report by Tom Gordon. An independent Scotland would Westminster's hostile approach to immigration and welcome more migrants in order to boost the economy, ministers have said. The Scottish Government said it wanted to create a more humane and dignified asylum system that addressed imbalances caused by historical inequalities and power dynamics. SNP ministers said the approach would be rooted in equity for the global south, with robust protections of migrants' rights and a new commissioner to speak up for migrants. Unlike at present, people seeking asylum would have the right to access public funds, including mainstream social security benefits. They would also have the right to work and pay tax to help support themselves. The proposals are set out in the sixth paper in the government's controversial Independence Perspectives series, Building a New Scotland, which was published this morning. It does not contain any figures on projected migrant numbers after independence. The proposals include new visa routes to make it easier for people to live, work, study and invest in Scotland, as part of efforts to increase the working age population. Without inward migration, Scotland's population is projected to decline, with the number of working age people falling, while the number of elderly people they need to support rises. The Scottish Government said its plans could also help address depopulation in rural and island areas and provide skilled workers in tourism and hospitality. The immigration system would be simplified, with lower fees and new public agencies to manage new migration, and citizenship systems would operate. Ministers also said the free movement of people between Scotland and the EU would be restored if Scotland rejoined the bloc after independence. Unionist parties complain the papers are a waste of public money, given there seems little prospect of a referendum in the coming years. However, launching the paper in Dundee, SNP Social Justice Secretary Shirley Ann Somerville said, "Our future success as a country is dependent above all else on the people who live here, and we value all those who have chosen to settle in Scotland for their invaluable contribution to our society and economy. This paper published today sets out how, with independence, we could help ensure that success with a migration system specifically tailored to Scotland's needs to make it easier for more people to settle and integrate here. Scotland's population is set to fall, unlike other UK nations, under current constitutional arrangements. This means fewer people working, paying taxes and contributing to public services like the NHS. Yet Scotland is subject to the UK government's hostile approach to immigration, which is damaging our economy. Control of our own migration policy would enable us to replace that approach with a system that has dignity, fairness and respect at its core, recognising above all that this is about individuals and their families. It is these values that will determine an independent Scotland's approach to migration and asylum policy, to benefit our country and the people who would call it home." The paper said Scotland would take a fundamentally different approach to the rest of the UK on immigration and asylum, with more routes in for people fleeing climate change. It said, "Unlike current UK policy, people seeking asylum would have the right to work, have access to employment support and to public assistance through, for example, our social security system, reducing the likelihood of destitution. Those granted refugee status would be granted settlement status in Scotland. This would support longer-term integration and reduce the need for refugees to have to go through additional administrative processes to stay in Scotland on a permanent basis. Finally, safe and legal routes would be available for displaced people and refugees, in part as recognition of the growing issue of climate refugees. This government would commit to engaging with partner countries and communities at risk of displacement from climate change to explore whether a humanitarian visa would play a part in our wider approach to climate justice." It said a Scottish system would also pay particular attention to policy for the global south, Latin America, the Caribbean, Asia, Africa and Oceania. Approaches to immigration in the global south can often, through combinations of post-colonial legacies, unconscious and conscious bias, and systemic or institutional racism, lead to discriminatory outcomes for people from minority ethnic backgrounds. This is true in the UK and was highlighted acutely in the scandal of the treatment of people of the Windrush generation. This government would seek to create systems that foster fairness and justice between the North and the South by addressing imbalances caused by historical inequalities and power dynamics. as well as avoiding migration policies which contributed to the brain drain in the global south, the paper said Scotland would introduce a migrants commissioner to be responsible for speaking up for migrants and those affected by the system, and put in place empowered external scrutiny of migration policy in an equivalent and enhanced role to that of the UK Independent Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration. Scottish Tory Chairman Craig Hoy said, "This latest propaganda paper highlights once again how totally out of touch the SNP are with the public. While Scots want and expect ministers to focus on the issues that matter to them, Hamza Yousaf is squandering more taxpayers' money and civil service resources on his independence obsession. This is unacceptable, especially when his government is imposing swingeing cuts to key public services." That report was by Tom Gordon.
The Herald on the 3rd of November, and the Voices section. E-bike riders in cycle lanes are scary, but the work is hard, by Katrina Stewart. I had a 1950s style upbringing in the 1980s in what was a very low-tech household, and I point to that as my excuse when I'm routinely flabbergasted by the wonders of the modern world. It was thus at a friend's house when he decided he wanted a specific type of thermometer to check his baby's temperature, so I looked it up on Amazon and had it delivered before I'd finished my cup of tea. My mind blown. His mind blown at discovering this was new to me. I'd like to tell you this was 5 years ago, but it was a few months. And so I have been very late coming to food delivery apps. Open the app, choose what you like for dinner, someone drops it at your front door a short while later. If I was rich, I would never cook again. Such convenience. But we will never learn that convenience for one group of people doubtless has a knock-on effect for another group of people. What cost my hand-delivered kimchi pancake? Well, a high cost for the hand deliverer. Deliveroo, one of several high-profile food delivery services, said that during the pandemic, its delivery riders doubled from 2020 to 2021 to more than 50,000 across the UK. Delivery riders are one of the fast-growing forms of employment. No wonder. Ordering food on demand at all hours is an extravagance, a luxury, but one that has become utterly mainstream and taken for granted. Because it's just so taken for granted, we expect the food to be delivered fast without any thought for exactly our desires are being served. The delivery riders are classed as self-employed, so they do not benefit from national insurance contributions. There's no company pension, no holiday pay. Couriers earn around £60 to £80 for 12 hours work, while the Bureau of Investigative Journalism found riders were earning on average less than the national minimum wage for those over 25, while I also spoke to one who was earning just £2 an hour. Riders talk about hanging around for an hour between deliveries, dead time for which they are not paid. One told a newspaper that it was akin to waiters only being paid for the time they carry plates to the table. To earn any kind of money, the delivery riders have to compete for jobs, and they have to take on as many jobs as they can. And so, is it any wonder the bikes they use have moved from bikes to e-bikes, to those chunky, fast, careening road monsters that seem to darken the way of every bike lane in every city? These things feel menacing and intimidating, and I'm sure I'm not alone in feel a twinge of dread every time I see one coming towards me. They give me the collie wobbles every time. I know two people who have been injured by delivery e-bikes, one with fat wheels and hand protectors on the handlebars, and feel a sense of there but by the grace of God. Ben Williams, a PhD student who happens to be a friend of a friend of mine, spoke to the BBC about an awful incident he endured with a food delivery driver. He was on a two-lane bike path when a food delivery courier travelling the wrong way, and Ben thinks using his mobile phone while riding an electric bike crashed into him. He ended up with a torn kidney, was very ill, and had to move back to Manchester from Glasgow to stay with his parents during his recovery. The issue, which has been ongoing for some time, has hit the headlines recently with a spate of media coverage of these bikes, what are technically called electrically assisted pedal cycles, the APC. An electric bike is supposed to give the rider a wee boost, but not take on all the work. So you should always need to pedal, and the electric assistance should cut out when the bike hits 15.5 miles per hour. An e-bike, which continues to assist the rider after 15.5 miles per hour, or doesn't need them to pedal at all, are not classed as EAPCs, and require a license, helmet, tax, and insurance, and can only be ridden on roads or unrestricted byways. David Kennedy, General Secretary of the Scottish Police Federation, pointed out that some people will buy e-bikes, assuming they are legal, because it's possible to buy them and not realise what they've bought is classed as a moped. Some of the bikes hurtling up the cycle lanes, often going the wrong way, certainly look like mopeds. Electric bikes used for couriering should really be a positive step. Since the first COVID lockdown, the number of companies using electric cargo bikes has soared, and there are around 450 independent businesses and tradespeople using them UK-wide. They cut carbon emissions and make streets quieter and roads safer, but when used as the law intends them, and when used responsibly. The problem is they're a menace. Police Scotland is obviously upping the public visibility of its officers' actions to prove it's doing something of the issue. The force's various ex-accounts have been posting about e-bike seizures and associated arrests. The Greater Glasgow account posted that 12 illegal e-bikes were seized last weekend as part of what it said was an operation targeting those riding illegally modified electric bikes capable of going at high speeds. Road Policing Scotland ex-account posted that a cyclist who failed to stop at a red traffic light at a pedestrian crossing, while officers from the motorcycle unit were dealing with him, they found he was in the UK illegally. He was arrested and is now being dealt with by the Home Office. The cyclist is on a modified e-bike with an orange food delivery bag. Cycling Scotland rightly says that a long-term approach has to be taken. Food delivery companies must give cycling safety training, plus check that their couriers are using legal and roadworthy bikes. But there's no sign of that anytime soon. I worry, though, that the conversation around these illegal bikes sidelines or even dehumanizes the people riding them. Do I want the bikes off the pavement and the bike lanes? I do. Do I want people arrested and deported because ultimately they were forced by market pressures into making bad decisions? I do not. My chain came off my bike the other week in Glasgow's South City Way bike lane. The only person who stopped to help was an Uber Eats cyclist. He didn't speak much English, but he took my bike and flipped it and refitted the chain, despite the value of his time. I just feel worthless, a delivery cyclist recently told a newspaper. Most customers are fine, but a significant minority treat you like a personal servant. They don't even look at you when they take their food. If you start to treat someone like they're invisible, they begin to act like they're invisible, and that's when accidents happen. And that was by Katrina Stewart. The Herald on the 3rd of November and the Voices section. I'll tell you the secret, a Scottish encounter with the Doctor by Mark Smith. Tell me you love Doctor Who and I'll tell you who you are. You are a man, probably. You are middle-aged. You don't find it particularly easy to make friends, and you are definitely not the most popular kid at school. You still get lonely, and sometimes you obsess about mistakes and wonder if what you'd do if, like the Doctor, you could travel back in time. There's a few things you'd change, definitely. What's happening, obviously, is I'm describing me, but you'd be amazed how often the pattern fits fans of Doctor Who. Believe me, I know. When I was a kid growing up in Aberdeen in the 1970s and 80s, the local Doctor Who group was a sanctuary for people who were different, awkward, and withdrawn. Teenagers several tables away from the table where the cool kids sat. In some cases, the difference was too much. My friend Stephen, for example, who committed suicide in his 20s. But the doctor was always there, and he was different as well. So we loved him. And now he is 60 years old, or at least the program is. The first episode was shown in November 1963. And the BBC is making a bit of a fuss. They just put every single episode up on iPlayer. And if you're minded to dip in, I can recommend three of the best to start with. The Robots of Death, the one where the AI starts strangling people. Earthshock, the one where, oh my god, they turn up at the end of episode one. And Inferno, the one where the Doctor tries to stop the world ending and fails. Watch those and tell me this isn't the greatest show ever made. But I must admit, I even struggle sometimes to truly understand why a so-called children's program, age 60, is still the main obsession for a so-called adult like me, age 53. I should have grown out of it by now, shouldn't I? Then I remember something the Doctor himself said. What's the point of being grown up if you can't be childish sometimes? But mainly I remember an extraordinary conversation I had with the greatest Doctor himself, Tom Baker, in the Highlands, in Kingussie, in a caravan that was smaller on the inside. Baker was in Scotland to make an episode of the TV show Monarch of the Glen, and he and I talked for half an hour or so in the caravan about his remarkable conversion from monk, he trained for 6 years, to Time Lord, he was the Doctor for 7, and as expected, he was compelling and hilarious and outrageous. I asked him how he lost his faith. It vanished swiftly when I bumped into a couple of girls in Germany, he said. But it was when I asked him about the secret of Doctor Who that I really paid attention. I'll tell you what the secret is, he said. It's that universal thing. This amazement. Suddenly a box appears and a door opens and a fellow comes out and says hello. And then he can take you somewhere. And I thought, yeah, that's it. It's possibilities of somewhere, accompanied by a someone who isn't like all the others. And the wonderful thing is Baker seems to apply the philosophy to his own life. If your whole life is Kingussie or Newton Moore, he said, you know, nice place to be, but if you think that's the world, you're wrong. And I get what he means. He isn't slagging off Kingussie or Newton Moore necessarily. He's tapping into the feeling that people sometimes get in villages and towns and suburbs where nothing much happens, and the stuff that does happen isn't to your liking. The feeling that there's something else. Some people find something else in a job, or a cause, or politics, or a girlfriend, or boyfriend, or music, especially music. But for Doctor Who fans, it's always in their favourite show. Travel back to 1974 and you'll find the 4-year-old me being transported to somewhere else every time he watched the man in the scarf fight the worst the universe had to throw at him. And the same rule applies now I'm nearly 54. I am growing up, so some people tell me. But the point is, sometimes I want to be childish. And that was by Mark Smith.
From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 6th of November, from the news section, Rishi Sunak responds to claim that a Tory MP is a serial rapist. Article by Tom Gordon. Rishi Sunak has described claims that a Tory MP is a serial rapist as very serious. However, the Prime Minister insisted his party's complaints procedures were robust, despite allegations the Conservatives may have covered up the scandal for years. The Mail on Sunday reported that former Tory party chairman Sir Jake Berry wrote to the police last October after learning about claims against the unnamed MP. The paper said he warned the police that an internal failure to act on allegations allowed the man to continue to offend and that he may have attacked up to 5 victims. Some of the allegations included multiple rapes. Deputy PM Oliver Dowden, who was party chair in 2021 and 2022, when an alleged cover-up took place, categorically denied being part of any such thing on Sunday. However, he could not discount a claim that the party paid for one of the alleged victims to receive treatment at a private hospital after she suffered mental health problems. I'm not denying that it could be the case that those payments were made, but it is not something that I authorised or was part of as chairman of the Conservative Party, he told Times Radio. Speaking on a visit to Bacton Gas Terminal in Norfolk today, the Prime Minister told broadcasters, these are very serious, anonymous allegations. It may be that they allude to something that is already the subject of a live police investigation, so I hope you understand it wouldn't be right for me to comment on that further specifically. More broadly, the Conservative Party has robust independent complaints procedures in place, but I would say to anybody who has information or evidence about any criminal acts to of course talk to the police. That's the right course of action. Labour Party Chairwoman Annalise Dodds called the allegations deeply concerning and extremely serious, and urged the Tories to investigate. Liberal Democrat Chief Whip Wendy Chamberlain also urged Mr Sunak to launch an investigation over the deeply disturbing claims. On Sunday, Mr Dowden told broadcasters he was not aware of the allegations and did not know who the alleged culprit was. He told the BBC, "I don't recognise in any form the idea that we covered up." The Mail on Sunday said Sir Jake wrote the letter, co-signed by former Chief Whip Wendy Morton, shortly after leaving the party chairman's job in October 2022. And that article was by Tom Gordon.
From the Herald, Monday, 6th November 2023. Sports section. Celtic fans group, the Green Brigade, shown support from ultras worldwide. By Ewan Payton, sports writer. Worldwide backing for the Green Brigade has filtered through over the weekend amid their ongoing dispute with Celtic. Last week, around 250 season ticket holders from the ultras group were suspended from attending matches at Parkhead. The Celtic board pointed out six incidents of unacceptable conduct as they launched the ban, but insisted it wasn't to do with the support of Palestine amid their ongoing conflict with Israel. The 2-1 win over St Mirren on Wednesday night was the first match of the suspension, with the section in the north curve of the stadium only sparsely full. The ban is in place pending further review, as stated in an email alerting those affected by the decision. It also prevents Green Brigade members from attending away games. On Friday night, PSG fans sent the Green Brigade a message of support during their side's 3-0 win over Montpellier. The Parisians unveiled a small green banner which read, "Green Brigade until the last rebel." Now it has emerged that several other ultra groups from across the globe have voiced their displeasure at the Celtics board's actions towards the Green Brigade. Sharing pictures of various displays on X, North Curve Celtic said, "From around the world, football fans have sent messages of support to the 304 Celtic fans currently subject to a collective and indefinite suspension from matches following actions in solidarity with Palestine. Thank you for your support." One message from Ultra Eagles, Raja Casablanca, read, "From 06 to 06, hold your head up high. You are by the right side. Ultra." Green Boys Raja Casablanca said, "You will never silence the Green Brigade." Another display from Ultra's White Knight Samalek read, "From Cairo to Glasgow, support Green Brigade." Gate 9, Pacamonia showed their support. "Football belongs to the fans. Solidarity with the Green Brigade." Supporters of Melamontau Football Club Paris, France, posed for Palestine flags and a message stating, "Palestine, you'll never walk alone. We stand with the Green Brigade." The last remaining Omonia Nicosia placed aimed a blast at the Parkhead hierarchy against the bans from the board. "We stand with the Green Brigade." That article was by Ewan Payton.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Monday, the 6th of November, 2023. From Voices section. The Herald Diary, Floored by a Door. Report by Lauren Jackson. Donna Murphy tells us she's delighted to have found the perfect Christmas present for her slightly less than dynamic husband. Lack of action, man. Floored by Door. The diary continues to be the only news outlet on the planet that dares to delve into the most provocative and scandalous subjects. For instance, a correspondent recently pointed out that a nefarious linguistic trick has been perpetuated on human society, with door signs often stating push or pull. The words look disconcertingly similar,
which means that an innocent wayfarer is more than likely to stroll up to a door and begin pushing when he should be pulling, or vice versa. The diary, which doesn't merely identify a problem but also devises a dazzling solution to it, suggested swapping push and pull door signs for the clearer and more exciting barge and yank. Reader Robert Menzies argues that the problem is more technological than linguistic. When you have push pads and pull handles for single handle doors, he says, it's generally only a matter of minutes before you will get somebody pushing on the pull handle. Adds Robert, I speak from experience. What was embarrassing in my case was that I was the architect who designed the system. Mind your language. The drama of grammar. A diary reader recently recalled being taught in school that a certain turn of phrase was considered bad form to use when writing, which reminds Margaret Thompson of her own higher education and a rule that was drummed into her young mind. The teacher helpfully explained, with is a very bad word to end a sentence with. The big difference. A huge number of controversial and downright daft opinions somehow always find their way onto social media. See Gary Lineker's numerous missives for evidence of this phenomenon. Why does this invariably happen? Diary correspondent David Donaldson tells us of a startling study that may have alighted upon the answer. Says David, a recent research project has discovered that large amounts of alcohol increases the size of the send button by 87%. Step too far. A resident of Eastern Bartonshire with a keen appreciation of literature gets in touch to ask, was John Buchanan forced to call his thriller The 39 Steps because the construction firm ran out of building materials? Nifty nicknames. We continue celebrating memorable workplace monikers. Says Peter Wright from West Kilbride, there was a joiner in my firm called Lightning because he could never hit the same place twice. In full bloom. Fun film fact from reader Bruce Johnson. Anyone who says they want to be a fly on the wall hasn't watched enough Jeff Goldblum movies. That report was by Lauren Jackson.
Herald Scotland, recorded on Monday, 6th of November 2023. Arts and Entertainments. Vinyl Records Revival Could Be Already Over? By Barry Didcock, Senior Features Writer. To misquote Philip Larkin, vinyl died for me in 1993, between the beginning of the end for grunge and the recording of the first Oasis CD. I say CD because, while that now iconic album may have been available in vinyl, I'm definitely, maybe, sure the vast majority of the millions of copies sold were 12 centimetres across rather than 12 inches, and made from shiny plastic rather than the grooved black stuff. If Creation Records founder Alan McGee is reading and knows otherwise, perhaps he'd like to get in touch. Of course, you don't need me to tell you, vinyl has since staged a resurrection. Big time. According to The Economist, the vinyl market in 2022 was worth just under £1.4 billion and is expected to hit £2.3 billion by 2028. In the UK, meanwhile, we bought 5.5 million vinyl records last year, the 15th successive year the domestic market has grown. In the US, music lovers bought 43.5 million vinyl albums, and the format was as popular with 25 to 34-year-olds as with over 55s. In large part, it's due to the success of Record Store Day, RSD, initiated in the US in 2007 as a way of celebrating, i.e. boosting the income of, independent record shops. By hymning vinyl, it also gave a slowly revolving, 33 RPM, two fingers to CDs. Today, it implicitly offers the same gesture to streaming. The idea is artists or labels produce special, vinyl-only editions available only at specific shops on a specific day in April, though the unsold stuff usually sits in a box near the front door for weeks afterwards. Since 2010, RSD has also been held to coincide with Black Friday in November, which this year falls in November 24. Among the delights lined up are Guts, the Secret Tracks by Olivia Rodrigo, a 12-inch EP on opaque, deep purple vinyl with four tracks on side A and a butterfly etching on side B. Rap fans, meanwhile, can queue for Post Malone's The Diamond Collection, a deluxe double LP on clear vinyl, or I Am Music by Lil Wayne, colour translucent ruby. And if your tastes veer more towards Joni Mitchell, The Doors, Charlie Mingus, or U2, There are variously reissues, live albums and demo collections featuring those artists. Here's the thing though, 1 million of those US vinyl sales and 80,000 of the UK ones were for a single album, Midnights by Taylor Swift, available in 4 colours plus a lavender-hued special for discount retailer Target and its 2,000 plus US stores. As for Olivia Rodrigo, Guts topped the album charts in 14 countries including the UK. Post Malone and Lil Wayne, their offerings are both greatest hits collections and the former's is so titled because it contains 9 diamond certified singles. None of these acts are exactly cutting edge, and clearly these albums aren't the sort of underground releases RSD once championed. Which begs the question, is vinyl now facing a second death? To some, it looks like it. For a start, its current popularity is such that actually pressing a record is becoming more and more difficult. Where once it took a month or 6 weeks for bands to have an order fulfilled, the waits are now more commonly 6 months or a year. Some, like veteran indie campaigner Damon Krukowski of Galaxy 500, blame Taylor Swift. Reposting an ad for the Midnight's vinyl edition, he tweeted, "Did you know none of the rest of us can get any vinyl pressed?" Others point fingers elsewhere, but always at huge stars and major labels with serious clout when it comes to block booking time at vinyl pressing plants. Predictably, it's the smaller acts which lose out. Then there's price. Swift's latest release, her re-recording of 2014's 1989, will cost you just shy of £40 if you want it on vinyl. Colour, Crystal Skies Blue. Even Definitely Maybe will cost you around £30. As of lunchtime Friday, you could fly from Edinburgh to Brussels for the same amount. Is that sustainable for music fans? When it's estimated half of US vinyl buyers don't even own a turntable, is it even moral? Finally, there's the big E, the environment. Vinyl records are made from plastic which can't be recycled. Their manufacturer produces around 0.5 kilogram of carbon dioxide per album, equivalent to 2 miles in a petrol-driven car. Sure, British company Evolution Music is pioneering the use of compostable bioplastics in place of PVC, but you can imagine the wait for that. Unsurprisingly, many young bands are now turning from vinyl to the most unloved format of the lot. Edinburgh duo No Windows, winners of the Best Newcomer accolade at last month's Scottish Album of the Year Awards, have an EP out at the moment, on cassette. Are you ready for that revival? By Barry Didcot.
The Herald on the 7th of November and the news section. Terrifying. A&E waits longest for 6 months going into winter. By Tom Gordon. The performance in Scotland's A&E units has fallen to a 6-month low, fueling fears of a terrifying crisis during the busy winter season. The proportion of patients waiting more than half a day to be treated was the highest since January. Public Health Scotland reported just 63.2% of patients were seen within the official 4-hour target last week, down from 64.9% the previous week. It was the poorest performance since 63.1% in mid-April. In addition, the number of people enduring extreme waits was the highest since late March. In the weekend in October 29, the number of patients forced to wait more than 4 hours rose from 8,304 to 9,165, as overall attendances rose from 23,658 to 24,873. The number waiting more than 8 hours rose from 2,995, 12.7% of patients, to 3,580, 14.4%, while those waiting more than 12 hours rose from 1,355, 5.7%, to 1,644, 6.6%. Although the number of patients waiting more than 12 hours was higher in the week to March 26 and 1,668, 6.5%, in percentage terms it was the highest since the week ending January 15, when it was 7%. The target is for 95% of patients to be admitted, transferred or discharged within 4 hours. It has not been met nationally since July 2020. The worst performing health board last week was NHS Forth Valley, with just 42.8% of patients seen within 4 hours. Then NHS Lanarkshire, 53.2%, and NHS Lothian, 59.8%. Tory MSP Dr. Sandesh Gulhain said these appalling and unacceptable A&E figures get worse by the week, which makes the approaching winter even more terrifying for overstretched staff and patients alike. Michael Matheson must get a grip of this crisis, which stems from the dire workforce planning of successive SNP health secretaries and Hamza Yousaf's failed recovery plan. It is intolerable that over a third of patients are waiting 4 hours to be seen, while more than 1,600 in a week waited over half a day in what's meant to be an emergency ward. The tragic reality is that lives will be needlessly lost due to these delays, despite the best efforts of dedicated staff. And that was by Tom Gordon. The Herald on the 7th of November in the news section. First Bus is offering free travel this Remembrance Sunday by Katrina Stewart. Veterans and Armed Forces personnel are being offered free bus travel this weekend to mark remembrance events taking place. First Bus is making the offer to those travelling to Greater Glasgow to Remembrance Day activities on Armistice Day on Saturday and Remembrance Sunday. The company said it has a strong link with the Armed Forces community, with large numbers of veterans now working for the business. And this is the bus firm's way of showing gratitude to those who serve or have served their country. Simon Pearson, Chief Commercial Officer at First Bus, said, "Remembrance Sunday is an important and solemn reminder of the sacrifices made by so many in our armed forces, and we wanted to do something to mark the occasion. We have a number of veterans working for First Bus across our Scotland depots, and we're very proud of their efforts and sacrifice. This is our way of saying thank you to them, as well as honouring all men and women who choose to serve and protect the freedoms our country now takes for granted." First Bus is also to donate £5,000 to Erskine Veterans Charity, who provide care, compassion and support to nearly 1,000 residents and their families each year. During the First World War, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, the guns of the Western Front fell silent after more than 4 years of continuous warfare. Every year, this historic moment is commemorated with a 2-minute silence on what is now known as Armistice Day. Sarah Bannerman, Head of Fundraising and Communications at Erskine Veterans Charity, said, "We extend our sincere thanks to First Bus for their donation of £5,000 in support of our veterans. This generous contribution will help provide vital care, support, and ultimately improve the overall well-being and quality of life of veterans here at Erskine. We're also delighted to hear about the initiative offering free travel for veterans on Remembrance Day, which we are sure will be greatly appreciated by the veterans community. Their support is testament to the commitment of First Bus to our veterans and their commitment to making a positive impact on the lives of those who serve for our country. To be eligible for a free return journey, veterans and military personnel can either wear their military uniform or show the bus driver their service ID card." And that was by Katrina Stewart. The Herald on the 7th of November and the news section. Rishi Sunak pitches for English votes by talking tough on crime by Tom Gordon. Rishi Sunak is expected to put a series of law and order measures that don't include Scotland at the heart of his first King's speech today. In a potential headache for the Scottish Tories at the general election, the Prime Minister will focus on crime and prisons south of the border as he tries to eat into Labour's poll lead. Mr. Sunak's first legislative programme and his last before the election due by January 2025 will promise tougher sentences for killers, rapists and grooming gang leaders. In a bid to paint Labour as soft on crime, killers convicted of the most horrific murders would expect whole life orders, meaning they will never be released. Rapists and other serious sexual offenders would not be let out early from prison sentences. Other measures include empowering police to enter a property without a warrant to seize stolen goods, such as phones, if there's reasonable proof a specific stolen item is inside. That could mean using a device's GPS tracking capability to lead officers to it. Mr. Sunak said, "I want everyone across the country to have the pride and peace of mind that comes with knowing your community, where you are raising your family and taking your children to school, is safe. That's my vision of what a better Britain looks like. Thanks to this government, crime is down, but we must always strive to do more, taking the right long-term decisions for the country and keeping the worst offenders locked up for longer. In the most despicable cases, these evil criminals must never be free in our streets again. Life needs to mean life." However, the promise of longer sentences comes as the English prison system is under extreme strain, with ministers forced to act last month to free up space by letting out some less serious offenders up to 18 days early. The UK government has promised the largest prison building programme in 100 years, creating over 20,000 more places. It will be the first state opening of Parliament by King Charles III, although he delivered the last Queen's speech of Elizabeth II's reign in place of his mother in 2022. Other measures expected in the King's speech include a law to mandate annual oil and gas licensing in the North Sea, a key dividing line with Labour. The plan started to unravel yesterday after UK Energy Secretary Claire Coutinho admitted it might not cost household energy bills, although it could raise tax revenue for public services. The UK government said on Sunday the increase in North Sea exploration meant a more robust energy mix will help to lower household bills in the long term. Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer said the stories can't fix a country because they've already failed, with a legacy of stagnant growth, skyrocketing mortgages, soaring prices and crumbling schools and hospitals. Rishi Sunak admits the country needs to change, but this government cannot deliver it. Choice facing the country is between a changed Labour Party, hungry to change the country through an exciting programme of long-term reform, and a Tory party with only gimmicks, division and more of the same. The Global Witness campaign warned UK refineries would be unable to process up to half of North Sea production by 2035, as the type of oil being extracted changed in character. The organisation said sites currently processed mostly light oil into petrol and other products, but the remaining oil being pumped out to the North Sea oil was increasingly heavy crude. Alice Harrison, fossil fuel campaign led at Global Witness, said Rishi Sunak's obsession with oil in today's King's speech is a red herring. The UK can't process the oil we produce, and fresh analysis today shows the situation is only getting worse. Drilling and exporting more planet-wrecking fossil fuels will do nothing for the UK's energy security or household bills, and will only line the pockets of a small handful of firms. And that was by Tom Gordon.
This is from the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 7th of November, 2023, from the business section. Scotland Homes, Perth Housing and Transport Hub approved. This article is by Brian Donnelly. Plans to create 1,500 new homes and a new large-scale green commercial development have been approved. The Perth West development has been granted planning permission by Perth and Kinross Council in a move it is claimed paves the way to over 1,000 new jobs at a major commercial site that will provide electric charging and hydrogen refueling facilities. Perth West includes 25 hectares of land for commercial development, where direct access to the A9 as well as core electricity infrastructure will create highly skilled job opportunities for Perth. There are also plans for 1,500 energy-efficient homes set out in a 15-minute neighbourhood design with electric vehicle and electric bike charging infrastructure, car sharing options, public transport and cycle paths. The longer-term impact of the development is forecast to bring 1,090 permanent skilled jobs. Construction of the development will provide 1,285 temporary jobs, generating a one-off boost of £118.7 million to the local economy. The Perth West project is forecast to generate £493 million additional GVA to the economy of Tayside over 25 years, plus council tax and business rates revenue. Alexander Dewar of the developers, the John Dewar Lambakin Trust, said, "Perth West offers huge benefits for the city of Perth, the wider region, and for Scotland. It is a blueprint for moving ahead with decarbonised transport systems and logistics, 15-minute cities, and innovation in low-carbon technologies and businesses." He added, "We must reduce our carbon emissions and we can create skilled jobs and high-quality housing at the same time, ensuring a brighter future for the region and the country. I look forward to positive engagement with the Scottish Government to ensure the core infrastructure is delivered to realise the aspirations of this development, which is both good for Perth and vital for Scotland. The location of Perth West, adjacent to the Broxton roundabout and the A9, has been described by Professor Sean Smith, Director of the University of Edinburgh's Centre for Future Infrastructure, as a strategic site for Scotland and the UK, benefiting from the proximity of the trunk road network and the high voltage transmission network. Improvements to the road network delivered as part of the Perth West include a new grade-separated junction that will open up 25 hectares of land planned for advanced logistics and low-carbon innovation. The site will host electric charging and hydrogen refueling facilities to support the transition of heavy and light goods vehicles to low-carbon technologies. That article was by Brian Donnelly.
That concludes this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Q and Review and tell your friends about our service.